Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Healthcare Committee. It's 4 o'clock on Thursday, February 18th. I would like to open a public hearing on 4105A.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, 4105A requires pharmacy or a pharmacist that dispenses biological product to communicate certain information electronically or to the prescribing practitioner. It provides for exceptions, aligns the definition of biological product with the federal definition, establishes a January 2, 2022 sunset date on the notification requirement, declares an emergency effective on passage. You have an A2 amendment that changes the terms to align with the Board of Pharmacy language and definitions, and those terms will be specified in the testimony, and it also clarifies that the board used the same federal definitions in their administrative rules. Left the House floor, 55 ayes and 2 noes, 3 excused. And we do have paperwork on the amendment, the A2 amendment, should the committee choose to take action today.
And our Representative Noss
is still
really
on the floor.
Wanted to come and so
does.
you're going to take him. So let's have Representative Noss's staff and Paul Costco. Please proceed.
Yes. Senator Montes Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Thomas Crawford, Representative Noss's chief of staff, and I'll be giving his testimony on his behalf. House Bill 4105 is an update to the biosimilar prescription drug notification bill that passed in the 2013 session. And what the bill does is the bill updates the statutes with the preferred term in the industry, substituting the word biologic and substitute biological rather than using the layperson word biosimilar. It maintains the required notification to the patient after a substitution of a prescribed biologic medication is made, and it maintains the current 3-year record retention requirement. Here's the change. HB 4105 restores notification from a pharmacist to the prescriber, doctor or nurse practitioner, after the pharmacist makes a substitution of a biological product. The concern that drove the need for this legislation was wanting to make sure that the medical provider finds out about a substitution of one biologic product for another when it was made by a pharmacist at the time of dispensing, because the patient might forget to let their provider know that a substitution was made. HB 4105 requires the pharmacist to notify the provider. Some stakeholders consider that requirement to have the pharmacist tell the provider that the substitution was made unnecessary and a bit of a hassle. The hassle factor has some insurance plans worried pharmacists will be discouraged from offering patients lower-cost biologic drugs. There are 5 different ways pharmacists are able to meet the notification requirements to the prescriber. Notice can be as simple as updating the billing system, which a pharmacist needs to do to be reimbursed. The notification might have to come by email or phone call to the provider for the rare self-pay patient, but those folks will be exceedingly rare in an ACA Obamacare world. I believe most pharmacists will be happy to suggest less expensive and just as effective medication, even if they have to take the extra step of notifying the doctor and the nurse practitioner. I don't believe having to give notice will be a barrier to them offering a less expensive drug. But to get the pharmacists and some of the insurance companies to neutral, we put a sunset on the notification from pharmacists to providers after 6 years. The sunset will allow us to examine again if the notification is still needed after we've become more comfortable with the substitute biologics. We can also examine how much work or hassle has been created for pharmacists and if notification really is a barrier to recommending a substitute biological when it makes sense to do so. Finally, it's important to know that currently none of this is actually happening, the substitutions and the notification. The Food and Drug Administration has not yet approved any substitute biological for distribution in the United States, but that day is coming soon. This bill puts a system in place once that happens. A lot of compromising has been done to get this bill to the shape that it's in. I think that because of that work, the bill was passed on the House floor with only 2 no votes. I'll close by saying thank you to all of the stakeholders that worked with me and with the representative on this bill, both proponents and opponents, which included numerous drug makers, the bio industry, patient advocacy groups, physicians and pharmacists, and health plans and insurance companies. Colleagues, members of the committee, I urge a yes vote.
Easy.
Not there yet.
He's getting ready. Madam Chair, may I? Paul Cosgrove, representing Amgen in support of the bill, and I'd like to just, in a little bit more detail, address some of the changes in the bill. First, I'd like to thank Representative Noss, Representative Williamson, and others.
Oh, Representative Noss, come on.
Now we can
your
say
colleague
colleagues.
Is here.
We just got done.
You just got done?
Well, with one bill. Hi, I'm Representative Noss. For the record, I represent Southeast Portland, House District 42. How'd you do?
He did good.
Good.
So, well, since his testimony has been read, let's continue with Paul, and then we can ask.
If there's any questions.
Or you can add to Representative Noss.
Thank you. And as Representative Noss, Paul Cosgrove again for the record, as Representative Noss was walking in, I was thanking him because I think this was a product that took a lot of time. There were very large and open-ended all-comers invited meetings that went on for multiple hours. And the result is the bill, including the A2 amendments, which I'll describe in just a minute. This is not the same bill as the one you saw in 2013. And I'd like to just point out the significant changes what's happened between now and then and now. One of the things that's happened is a whole lot of other states have moved in this direction. There are now 19 states that have adopted similar legislation. And in the last year, 2015, 11 states did. It's an interesting mix of blue states, red states, north states, south states, east and west. And all of them did it with overwhelming majorities. And that's a recognition that a lot of work has been done at the national level amongst all the drug companies and pharmacy groups and all the other interested parties to try to reach resolution on a system and a process that works, that is not as much as all the providers would like. It's a little bit more than the pharmacist would prefer, but it is a compromise in which has resulted to this point that providers and the major pharmacy groups have all become neutral or supportive of this bill. And people who opposed this bill in 2013, like the Generic Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association, are now strongly in support of the bill. So the significant changes are, first, in Representative Noss's testimony pointed this out, on page 2, starting in line 3 through line 11, talks about the notification back to the provider that a substitution has been made. First of all, the criteria is there has to be an interchangeable drug approved by FDA that's substituted. So this is not notification that happens with every filling of a prescription. And it is not notification that happens beforehand. It happens afterwards. And the four separate methods of notification of communication of the substitution are in lines 8 through 11, either for entry in an interoperable electronic records, medical records, which are being developed and maybe in our lifetime will become more ubiquitous, and that will be the preferred method. The second one, letter B, is by entry into an electronic prescribing technology. You would think of that as a PBM system. What happens when these drugs get entered into a PBM system, which every pharmacist has to do, of course, in order to find out whether the drug will be covered in the payment and the reimbursement and the copay and all those other things that are necessary to fill the prescription, is it goes into a second system called SureScripts, which is accessible to providers. It doesn't automatically give the information to providers, but it is a place, a location where that information can be retrieved if necessary. That's in letter C, a pharmacy benefit management system, or in some other kind of a medical record. We've also made it clear, and this is on page 2, lines 18 through 21, that if this is dispensed to a patient in a hospital, in a clinic, or an assisted living or nursing home, and those terms are being updated in the amendment, I'll discuss that in a second, then as long as it gets into the medical record, that's enough. And of course, that was what would happen if there was a dispensing happening at that location. There's been some question about, well, how many of these are going to happen, and does this apply every time a biological product is prescribed? And there are additional exceptions on page 2, starting at lines 25. First of all, and I mentioned this before, it doesn't apply unless there has been an interchangeable biological product substituted. So it does not mean that insulin from company A to insulin from company B, that is not an interchangeable biological substitution where this bill applies. It does mean that in the future, if there is a biosimilar insulin, which has not yet been developed, although one is in the process of being developed, then it would apply, but not the common and everyday occurrence now where different manufacturers of insulin, the patients may have switched those, and that none of this applies to that. Secondly, it does not apply if it's a refill, which is logical. There's only one notification. And lastly, it does not apply, and this was a request of one of the health plans to clarify, it never intended to apply to a vaccine, and it does not apply if a vaccine is administered by a pharmacy. These entries into these systems are presumed to be noticed. They are noticed. Whether or not the prescribing physician goes into the system and retrieves the information that's accessible to that prescriber or not, that's the full obligation of the pharmacist. Make the entry. They don't have to ensure that it gets to the prescriber. That's the prescriber's responsibility to go get it. The second change is with regard to the State Board of Pharmacy obligations, and this is also on page 2, starting in lines 34. Before, we said they should make a list of all of these interchangeable products. We've changed it to they need to have a link on their website to the FDA's list if there is one available, a simplicity that costs saves some money at the Board of Pharmacy. And then second, in addition, the Board of Pharmacy is directed to adopt the definitions of biologic product is exactly as stated in federal law, and we've done that because that's the negotiation that's been happening over the last year nationally that's resulted in bills passing at overwhelming majorities, is to update the definition to be exactly this. Lastly, there is a sunset, as mentioned. That was a concession to suggest that maybe this issue deserves reassessment in another 6 years. I've discuss this with some of you. It would be nice if in one of our lifetimes we had truly interoperable electronic medical records. I don't think it'll happen in 6 years, but we will hopefully make a good deal of progress toward that, and maybe a different system will be appropriate. And then lastly, I'd just like to mention the A2 amendment. The A2 amendment changes the definition of nursing home to long-term care facility and assisted living facility to community-based care facility. That's how those facilities are defined in the Board of Pharmacy rules, and the pharmacists ask us to make those changes. So that's one of the changes in the A2. It doesn't change the substance, but it changes and refers to the definitions that are familiar and that the Board of Pharmacy has already adopted. And then secondly, there was some concern by the Board of Pharmacy's attorney, the Assistant Attorney General, who advises the board, that our use of the words describe, where we're directing the board to use the definitions described in federal law, might require them to do a list from that perspective. And we negotiated that maybe the word define is more specific. We do not want the board to make a list, to incur the cost to make a list. We would like them to link to the FDA's list, if there is an FDA list, and to adopt the definitions in a simple rule that just repeats the federal definitions and then updates it as those changes occur in the future. With these changes, there is, and it's on the record on the House side, and I was authorized just today to inform you that Providence Health Plans, both the plans and the health systems, have had all of their concerns initially raised, addressed, and they are neutral on the bill. There's another health plan that has expressly told me that they are also neutral. There may be health plans that still oppose it. I'm quite certain there are, but I want you to know we worked very hard to address any concerns that we could identify as being legitimate concerns. We do not believe this will impinge upon the substitution of biologics. Amgen just filed its biosimilar last month. It has 8 more in the development stage. I think you know how expensive it is to develop drugs. It's even more expensive to develop biologics. We would not be spending hundreds of millions, literally billions of dollars in that development phase if, in fact, we didn't think those products were going to be used in the market. In fact, we think this bill is necessary in order to build confidence amongst our prescribers that these drugs, they'll have the information they need, so if there's a problem or an issue about lack of effectiveness, they'll be able to retrieve it and know what happens, and that the substitutions will occur at the pharmacy. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, if there are any. Thank you.
Okay, so on the dash twos, which you've described very nicely, is the house.
Oh, yeah, we'll concur with those. I mean, they're just definitional. Sorry for the record. Rob Noss, Southeast Portland, House District 42. We'll confer with those amendments. They're not controversial. They're just using the definition that the pharmacy folks think is the right one.
And concerns have been brought to me regarding, because we have federal guidelines, we don't really need this bill. Can you respond to that?
I'd be happy to give one response. The record, if you went on OLIS, it has not been repeated with duplicate copies of these letters on the Senate side, but it's still available to you on OLIS, that come from nearly every specialty health care institutional organization, specialty doctor organizations, and the Oregon Medical Association is strongly in support of this bill. And it's strongly in support of this bill because they believe it's necessary. I'm not sure if that directly answers your question, but there are lots of people who support this and support the changes here, and these changes are necessary, and they're the very ones that have been made in the other states to get these bills passed by overwhelming majorities. So that's
so you're saying that the California and the Washington has gone along with these changes.
Madam Chair, the definitions of what a biologic product is identical in Washington, California, and Oregon, with one exception. They made the definition directly part of statute. We, because of constitutional requirements, have to direct our agencies to make the definition consistent with federal law. That's the delegation of sovereign authority issue that is a special Oregon issue. That's the only change. The definitions themselves, the references to federal law, are identical.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. I will call up Louis Rodriguez and Courtney Dresser.
Thank you, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Louis Rodriguez. I am
back up just
oh,
a little.
Sorry.
Thanks.
I am the Government Relations Director for the State of Oregon with the American Cancer Society Cancer Action Network. ACS-CAN supports House Bill 4105, which reinstates the prescriber communication piece around the dispensing of a biologic product. We know that biologic products are very complex. They are grown in live organisms, which makes them especially complex. They're also taken by really seriously ill patients, such as our population, who are dealing with cancer. So those two things combined can make it a really tricky situation when we're talking about managing lots of different medications that are also especially strong. So we feel that the communication with the prescriber is necessary. I'll make the point that ACS-CAN is not opposed to automatic substitution of these products. We're fine with that, but we just want a little bit of extra information. So we want the prescriber to have the ability to access information should a patient have an adverse reaction, should a particular medication stop working as well. We want all of that information to be available. So I would urge your support of House Bill 4105, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, just quickly, I appreciate the points that are being made about this, and as a physician, obviously, I want to know what I can know about the drugs my patients are taking. I would argue pretty strongly that that's just as true for generics that are currently on the market that are considered to be bioequivalent, i.e. equally active, but I can tell you from personal experience that they're not, in the sense that depending on what the fillers are or whatever that are in them, people respond differently. And if I have a patient who's been stable on warfarin, a blood thinner, for a long time and all of a sudden they're not, I can pretty well guarantee you they got a different generic, right? I'm not objecting to that. I just like to know. So to be honest with you, and I said this over the past couple of years when we've been considering this topic, I don't think this should apply just to biologics. I think it should apply to every drug. And I'm not at all convinced that as a physician it's particularly useful to me to have it in some database that I didn't even know physicians could access, let alone how they can access it. And frankly, until there's a time when we can have this information fed back directly into the electronic health records for all the drugs, then I'm not going to know about my patient's compliance. I'm not going to know which generics they're getting. I'm not going to know if they're picking up their prescriptions on time, all of which would help me help them get better care and stay healthier. So I'm really puzzled still about this one. It seems really symbolic, and I understand that it's passed overwhelmingly. I've had this conversation with others. It's not like I'm saying anything that the advocates haven't heard me say privately before, so I'm not surprising anybody, I hope. So I'm really puzzled as to why this does anything that's going to make, I mean, granted, I don't prescribe biologics, right? That's outside my scope of practice. But I think the issues are just as big with generics.
So, Chairman Sanderson, Senator Steiner Hayward, thank you for the question, and certainly your insight as a physician is valuable. I'll let Courtney answer some of that. I'll just touch on, from my organization's perspective, from ACS CAN's perspective, these are especially complex drugs, as you know, and it's also especially complex populations. And you've heard some of the concerns from pharmacists and from insurers about this communication being an issue. So we're sort of weighing those things, and I don't think we would be ready to necessarily say that it should be applied to all generics, because those are, you know, issues that we're weighing. And so I'll let Courtney kind of touch on that issue in her testimony in terms of the prescribers.
Thanks.
Good afternoon. I'm Courtney Dresser with the Oregon Medical Association, and we do support this bill, and particularly the notification to providers. And I would say that it's not quite notification, not even quite communication, but it's an opportunity for providers to find the information if they so choose to find that information. I completely agree with Senator Steinman Hayward that this is probably a piece of a bigger conversation about how we continue to get better information into our electronic health records so our providers are aware of what is happening with our patients and that they can continue to provide the best of quality care. We're not quite there yet. They're not talking to each other. Not all these systems work. There's a lot of databases, but not everything seems to coalesce well, and we continue to work on that in other legislation, even this session. So it's a bigger piece of a puzzle, but this is part of that puzzle.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. The final two are Tom Holt and Nikki Terzieff.
Good afternoon, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. Nikki Terzieff here on behalf of the Oregon State Pharmacy Coalition. We are a coalition that represents both Main Street pharmacists and health system pharmacists that's based in hospitals or clinics. Working with Representative Nose over in the House and through the process in the House, really appreciated his engagement and personal attention to some of our concerns. We did actively go neutral on the bill over there, 4105, in no small part because he was able to provide us with a sunset clause. We appreciate that sunset clause on the provider notification piece because, as noted previously by Mr. these systems don't always work well together, and we believe that we were concerned that there would be some prohibitive requirements on notification for prescribers that were going to be an extra burden, an undue burden on pharmacists, and especially the small pharmacies and the Main Street pharmacists. We, while neutral, did on the House side also express some concerns around definitions. One was in definition of the long-term care, which Mr. Cosgrove pointed out was taken care of in this A2 amendment, I believe, and putting that under the definition for the Board of Pharmacy. The only other piece that one of our pharmacists raised, and this was one of our pharmacists, was a question around the shift in the language from biological products to biosimilars, and what was the impact on dispensing daily management therapy managements such as insulins.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Tom Holt with Cambia Health Solutions. We're opposed to the bill in its current form. I think it's important to talk about the context that this lands in. You know, one, we're seeing increasing use, partly because of some wonderful developments and innovation in the biologic space. Most of these drugs are what we call specialty drugs. They tend to be very, very expensive. Our trend lines on cost in specialty is very high. We're seeing year-over-year increases well into the double digits, and we're expecting specialty drugs to consume 50% of pharmacy budgets within the next 4 years. We have been down this road before on this subject, as you know. The bill passed in 2013, passed in the absence of a very clear FDA process for approving biosimilars, and so there was a sunset knowing that development of that was in process, and we had the sunset. There is now a very clear process, and yet we're back again. I would wager that we'll be back again the next time a sunset approaches. The way we see this bill is it's erecting some administrative requirements that don't otherwise exist for substitutions. And any time we create a barrier to any activity in healthcare, we know that you get less of it. We have to do some of that as a health plan with prior authorizations, and we impose those when absolutely necessary to discourage certain activities. And so what this bill is doing, we believe, as the bills do in other states where they've come into play, is discourage substitution of biosimilars when they become available. Not all pharmacies have access to the sorts of systems that are described in the bill as an easy out. As has been pointed out, there is no such thing as an interoperable record at this point in time. So we don't see it really adding anything in terms of access to information for prescribers that doesn't exist today. Today, pharmacies have to keep records for, I believe, 3 years after dispensing. And it's general practice, at least in my experience, when I go to my doctor, that I get asked what pharmacy I use. And so it's in my medical record what pharmacy the drug is coming from. And if my physician is curious about what ultimately was dispensed, they can inquire with that pharmacy and the information is available. So we're layering on some activity that doesn't really add benefit, but does add cost, does add barriers. We're very concerned about the definitional change and that it includes the insulin class. And there are hopefully some biosimilars coming down the pike for insulins. But to give you some idea of scale of that impact, the use of insulin today is about 10% of our total drug spend. The incidence of use of insulin versus other commonly used biological products, such as, say, Enbrel, which is common for arthritis, is about 12 times the usage. So this is not a narrow universe of products anymore. We don't believe the bill is really clear about the obligations of notice to the provider or to the patient in the event that there's not an in-person opportunity or some kind of instant communication. So for all those reasons, we oppose the bill. We think it's adding barriers and costs where it's not appropriate to do so. And frankly, given that we have no biosimilars really approved and in the market yet, there's no emergency that this February session needs to address. This could wait until we know more about this universe. But at the end of the day, we see no reason to second-guess the FDA. And I guess the last piece I would note is that we did introduce legislation in the last long session to actually just make it easier, to make it a lot like generics, and the manufacturers opposed that legislation. So I have to look at all this with somewhat skeptical eye.
Okay, are there questions? Okay. Okay, let's just stand at ease for just a minute. Sorry for the recess. We'll reopen the healthcare committee, and we're going to open a work session on House Bill 4105.
Madam Chair, I move the -A2 amendment into House Bill 4105.
Senator Cruz moves the -2 amendments into House Bill 4105. Is there any discussion?
Madam Chair,
yes.
I'm in a really tough place on this bill right now, and the dash A2s, you know, if it's going to pass, it's better to therein. So I'm not going to object to those. I had told some of the advocates that I was going to be okay with it. The more I've thought about it, the more I've learned and listened, the less comfortable I am. So I don't think you're going to need my vote, because I'm gathering that you've got the majority on this committee, and that's okay. I'm puzzled why we need this bill right now. I don't think as a physician it's going to do anything for me or for my colleagues. I think we can pick up the phone and call a pharmacy or ask the patient to bring the drug in if we're really wondering what they're getting. So I don't see the urgency for it. So, yes, I'm fine on the A2s, but I'm getting more and more anxious about the bill as a whole.
Fine. So see a unanimous vote for the A2 amendments. So that is adopted.
You're a good team.
I'm sure I move House Bill 4105A as amended by the A2 amendments to the floor to be passed recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4105 as amended with the A2 amendments. Is there any more discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator Haywood?
No.
Aye.
Chair Montes Anderson?
Aye. Motion carries. Senator Cruz, would you carry the bill, please?
Well, okay.
Okay. Note that Senator Cruz will carry the bill, and I'll close the work session on House Bill 4105. And I'm going to jump to House Bill 4141, because it seems like everyone's okay with that one. Okay. I'm hoping. Okay. Sandy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4141A authorizes the Oregon Health Authority to change size of the geographic area served by a coordinated care organization under specified conditions. It has a repeal date of December 31, 2018, declares an emergency effective on passage. This left the House floor with 57 ayes, 3 excused. There is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the bill. This was a representative Cedric Hayden bill. He was unable to be here, but there is written testimony from him on OLAs, so please be aware of that. He's obviously still in support of the bill, and we have some folks to testify.
Okay, Courtney Johnson, Cindy Becker, and Bill Murray.
Chair Montes Anderson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Courtney Johnston, and I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon, which is a coalition made up of 8 organizations that work with 8 of the 16 coordinated care organizations in Oregon. I'm here today in support of House Bill 4141A because CCOs were given 5-year contracts to serve a defined area, and this helps ensure that CCO can make long-term investments in their communities. Over the interim, the Oregon Health Authority established a rule aimed at providing consistent framework for when a CCO vacates a service area. However, one part of that rule gave the agency complete discretion in determining when a CCO would no longer be servicing all or part of a service area, and that's a quote from a legislative opinion that I believe is an OLAS. We appreciate the agency was willing to kind of work on the language, and they extended a comment period and gave us an opportunity to see to change the language, but when we got the language back on January 7th, it was clear that it still provided this level of uncertainty for the CCOs. So we brought the bill forward. We understand there are reasons for why the agency would need to work to initiate a service area change, but we believe that there is a mechanism provided in the contracts that allow them to do that, and allows them to do that in a way that provides due process to the CCOs, which we think is really important. And that's still there. This bill doesn't change that, but and this process is laid out in their contracts. agreements were set in the House that put a sunset of 12/31/18 on this bill, and so we think we've reached an appropriate compromise, and we think the bill is ready to move, and so COHO respectfully asks you to move the bill without amendments.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson and the committee. For the record, my name is Cindy Becker. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs for Family Care Health. We strongly support House Bill 4141, as was moved over from the House. Courtney explained that there was a process, actually there was a long real process last year for over 6 months, and the CCOs worked very collaboratively with the agency around the issues of what happens if a CCO withdraws or changes their service area. The difference was when the agency also added language that gave them the authority to change a service area. Also, there was a language that added if there was a prospective, if they thought there was an issue prospectively that was not defined. That gave us cause for a lot of anguish, a lot of concern. I can tell you, for family care specifically, the agency did use that language to send a letter out at the end of November to all the other CCOs asking if any of them wanted to take over family care's area. The amount of damage control that we had to do when providers heard about this, when staff heard about this, and when our members heard about this was pretty unbelievable. People were wondering if we were going out of business. We had no idea. We had no warning that this letter was going out. We had told the agency that we were planning for 2016. We have a signed contract for 2016, yet the agency has extended the service area change application through April. We have no idea why they've extended it through April. They signed our contract. We signed the contract. So this has really put a cloud of uncertainty around our members and our providers. We are reassuring them that we continue to be that we plan on continuing to be around for another 30 years, like we have been for 30 years. But this has caused a lot of work, and I said a lot of damage control. We believe the agency has the authority within the contract, if there is are issues that are discovered with a CCO, there, as Courtney said, there's language in the contract that addresses this issue. We also believe it's appropriate if a CCO withdraws from a from a service area that there is a process. And so we support this bill. We also would ask that the agency cease and desist their current the service area application. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Monis Anderson. My name is Bill Murray. I'm the Chief Operating Officer at Family Care. Thank you, members of the committee and Chair, to allow me to add to Cindy's comments. I think Cindy provided a great history of why this bill is important. I would also echo Courtney's comments that all the CCOs worked together, and this was basically language that all CCOs suggested go in the rule. And then that did not happen. So we are here today. This language supports what the CCOs worked together on, and all sent a letter to OHA in support of. So I would encourage you also to move this bill forward as it stands today. Thank you.
Okay, are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much. I would like to read into the record the testimony from the Oregon Health Authority. It says, Dear committee, the Oregon Health Authority appreciates the opportunity to testify on House Bill 4141A, and thanks Representative Hayden for bringing the bill forward. Oregon Health Authority agrees with the intent of the bill to provide clarity and direction in any future situation when the authority may contemplate adjusting a CCO service area. In 2015, OHA went through a collaborative rulemaking process to develop rules around service area changes for existing CCOs. Prior to this process, no guidance existed in either statute or rule. OHA believes that House Bill 4141A is a logical extension of this work and provides certainty to its partner CCOs that OHA will not make frivolous or unwarranted adjustments to CCO service areas. These protections are in the best interests of OHA's CCO partners and Oregon Health Plan members. Thank you for your consideration. Sincerely, Beth Ann Darby, External Relations Director. All right, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 4141 and open a work session on House Bill 4141.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 4141A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 4141 to the floor with a due pass.
Does Bates want to carry?
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. House Bill 4141 has been moved to go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Will the clerk, is there any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Yeah, there is, Madam Chair, because Senator Bates is in the room. We have a few issues still on the table that need to be addressed in 17. We know what they are, and fortunately, in the 17th session, we have unlimited bill writing ability, so we can take the issues one at a time in bill form. So,
great. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator
Bill?
Aye.
Senator
Shields?
Aye.
Senator Spanner Hayward?
Aye.
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Chair
Modis Anderson? Aye. Motion carries, and Senator Bates will carry the bill.
You're in the room, Alan.
Okay, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 41 and open a public hearing on House Bill 4107. Sandy.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4107A prohibits the Oregon Health Authority from retroactively changing terms of a contract with a coordinated care organization unless specified conditions are met. Takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment, sine die. You have two amendments, the A4s and the A5s. This left the, well, before we get to that, this left the House floor in the A version, 59 ayes, one excused. The A4 amendment specifies that the bill applies to the 2017 contracts and that the contract amendment must be approved by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. The A5 amendments specify that an amendment to a CCO is to be necessitated by a change in federal law, and it also adds an emergency clause.
All right. Courtney Johnson, Cindy Becker, Bill Murray.
And I do not have all the paperwork for these amendments, Madam Chair.
Okay, we got a moment.
We have one.
You know, I'm just letting you know. Ashley.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, hello again. For the record, Courtney Johnston here on behalf of the Coalition for a Healthy Oregon. The bill before you is pretty simple but very important. You may remember a few months ago the CCOs were dealing with some serious issues when the Oregon Health Authority decided to redevelop the 2015 reimbursement rates. When they redeveloped those rates, they determined, and this was 8 months into the year, and when they did that, they determined that those rates were going to be applied retroactively to January 1 of 2015, which caused many CCOs to have to pay back in the ballpark of in millions of dollars, which was a very difficult situation for them to be in. These are businesses that had budgeted and set expenditures for the year based on the understanding that that money was going to be there. CCOs need that budgetary certainty to provide care in their communities. This is especially important when we're talking about a healthcare delivery system that's tasked with providing chronic disease management, population health for the state's most vulnerable people, while also reducing the cost of care at the same time. All we're asking for today in this bill is that the budgets be set prospectively, as the law requires, and that CCOs can make proactive investment decisions. Because unfortunately, when the CCOs received their 2016 contract amendments, it allowed the agency to make retroactive changes to the CCO payment rates, effectively committing a CCO to retroactive payment adjustments at any time throughout the year. We believe this is not the way that the state should contract with its partners, and the bill before you simply disallows the agency from providing themselves this authority. COHO believes the bill and the -A5 amendments provide the agency with the ability they need to recoup payments if required by the federal government, but we believe that this is an important step to make to provide the CCOs with certainty that the budgets they get at the beginning of the year will be the budgets they have for that year. Thank you.
Thank you. For the record, Cindy Becker, Vice President of Public Affairs for Family Care Health. Family Care Health supports this bill with the -5 amendments. First of all, I want to thank Representative Davis for bringing this bill forward. As Courtney said, this is a very important bill. Because of what happened last year, with when the CCOs were faced with retroactive payments. And you know, we plan ahead. We use our dollars, we use our budget to plan ahead. And if we're always having to look over our shoulder, CCOs are not going to want to make the investments that the transformation really was all about. If folks are going to be concerned that at some point during the year, OHA may require a repayment, a retroactive payment. So this bill will prohibit that. The only circumstance, and this is why we want the Dash 5 amendments, is so that it would be allowed if there was a change in federal law. We also think it is critical that there's been a lot of questions about the language in the bill, even though the intent is clear. We want to, the Dash 5s, we believe, clarifies that to make sure that this cannot be applied to 2016, nor any years previously in the current contract. So we believe the Dash 5 amendments are critical. We also appreciate Senator Cruz requesting the Legislative Council opinion on this that also supports it. We believe that it's critical to have it in statute as well.
Good afternoon again, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Bill Murray. I'm Chief Operating Officer at Family Care. I would once again, it's nice to go third, but I would echo the comments of both Courtney and Cindy with regards to the critical importance of this bill. And what this bill does is it codifies with great certainty that there are no retroactive adjustments available to the authority for any reason other than what is a very limited exception that is provided in the bill. It's extremely critical that an organization knows, any business, be it healthcare or any other business, knows what money it has, how it's going to operate, and to have any uncertainty out there creates just a very difficult environment. This talks about the original part of the statute talks about an amendment is allowed when it's necessitated by changes in federal law. We would like that language, which is the correction in the Dash 5 amendments, to echo that same exact language that already appears in the statute. So it's very clear that we're not changing anything, that there's not a difference between what happens in an amendment versus a retro amendment. There are a few other small technical corrections, but the purpose of this is to make sure it's absolutely clear that there are no retros for any period of time up to today, and then in the future it is very, very limited and only upon change that is necessitated due to federal law change. I appreciate your close consideration of this, and I would recommend passage of the A5 amendments. Thank you.
Okay, I have two. I'd like you to stay there because I need to read these two testimonies into the record, and then I have question for you. So this one is from Representative Davis. He says, please enter this into the record. The intent of House members who carried this bill is in fact to prevent the abuse of provisions in the existing CCO contractual amendments that give the Oregon Health Authority the ability to claw back global budgets from regional CCOs. Existing contracts would not be amended by this bill and would not require resubmittal to CMS because their provisions would not be revised. Rather, clawbacks would only be allowed if the amendments is necessary to comply with federal law. The intent is that the bill apply to existing contracts, not prospectively, as would result from OHA's Dash 4 amendments. And we haven't talked about the Dash 4 amendments. Legislative Council has also made clear that the bill as drafted applies to the current rate amendments as is intended. That LC opinion has been submitted into the record. Because of that Legislative Council opinion, I do not believe any amendments are required and would ask the committee to move the bill as currently drafted. Please disregard the A3 amendment that has my name on it. So there I would like to know, I would like you to take your A5 amendments and get him on the record as supporting that. Now I'm going to read testimony from the Oregon Health Authority on the A4 amendments, correct?
Yes.
Okay, dear committee, the Oregon Health Authority appreciates the opportunity to testify in House Bill 4107 and the need for the addition of the A4 amendments. House Bill 4107A would prohibit OHA from retroactively changing terms of the contract of a coordinated care organization through a contract amendment unless certain conditions are met. These conditions include that the change would not result in a claim by OHA for a financial recovery of funds paid to a CCO prior to the effective date of the contract amendment, or that the amendment is necessary to comply with federal law. The bill also clarifies that proposed changes in a CCO's global budget, example, rates paid to the CCOs, must be given to CCOs with 60 days advance notice. OHA is neutral on this bill with the two clarifications contained in the A4 amendments, that it only apply prospectively beginning January 1, 2017, which I think you've already indicated that this will do, but I'll get you on the record on that, and two, that contract changes may occur when required by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, to receive their approval. After House Bill 4107A passed out of the House Health Care Committee, questions and confusion arose over the effective date. This A4 amendment clarifies that this bill applies only to future contract amendments beginning January 1, 2017, but does not disrupt or impact existing signed contracts and contract amendments. The contracts of all CCOs will be disrupted if HB 4107A were to apply to contract amendments that have already been signed and submitted to CMS for approval, meaning 2016. Additionally, the A4 amendments clarify that a retroactive change could be made if it is necessary to comply with the federal law or to receive contract approval by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. As OHA federal partner in the Medicaid program, CMS has final say on the CCO contracts and can require OHA to make changes not envisioned or captured during the development process with CCOs. CMS prefers to work collaboratively with states, and OHA needs to maintain the ability to comply when required in order to receive CMS contract approval. The dash A4s clarify that intent of the bill to allow retroactive provisions if required by the CMS to gain contract approval. Thank you for your consideration. Sincerely, Beth Ann Darby, External Relations Director. So what I need from you, because this bill will be coming back on next Tuesday, whatever date that is, that you look at the A4s and preferably on Monday have something in writing with your reaction to the A4s, and then I will ask OHA, which I know are watching this, to please respond to the dash A5 amendments and get writing back to us so we can share it, and you need to share it with the committee members so that we will be able to make a proper decision on Tuesday.
Madam Chair, I have two quick questions to add to the ones that you've asked, and I don't know who the right ones are to ask. I think one of the challenges that we had this past year when we were dealing with this rate issue was whether CMS required us to do those changes. Because CMS rarely states in writing that they actually require something to be done, but it was pretty clear that when they were sending back a letter with over 100 comments and concerns, that if changes weren't made to our rates, that we might be at significant risk. And as Ms. Darby's letter states, CMS tends to prefer to work collaboratively and not say, we won't do this unless you do that, because they like to keep places open. So I'm a little worried about the word required, and I want to make sure we have some clarity about what that means one way or another. And that's a question that I'd like to have brought back to us on Tuesday by whoever can bring us back an answer to that. The other question is whether we plan to have fiscal impact statements on any of these amendments, because I'm concerned.
We don't have
about
them now.
But, I'm just concerned about what the costs might be of any of these amendments, since we don't know, and I guess I'd like to know from whoever can, well, I mean, obviously LFO is the one who gives us fiscal impacts, but I want to make sure that we're not inadvertently setting ourselves up with either round of amendments. I don't know anything about either of them. So all I'm saying is part of my decision about which ones to move.
Okay, so
they've been
for both amendments.
Yes.
Both fours and fives. The fiscal statement has been ordered. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Of course, I'm really new at this healthcare stuff. So, first, when it comes to CMS, CMS doesn't know what it's doing. Pure and simple. Depends on who you talk to on any particular day. You can get yin and yang from them. But the reality of it is, if they have a requirement, we have to meet the requirement. The five specifically spell that out. But I'm going to step back a little bit further and back to the days when we were creating all of these things, okay? The CCOs were supposed to be created organically, okay? And they were supposed to get money, PMPM. And within that budget, they were supposed to do the best job they could to deliver health care based on the need of their community, okay? We're losing sight of that in all of this, okay? If we have federal issues and we got to do some readjusting, that's fine. But to have OHA arbitrarily decide to do readjustments, it violates the entire purpose of what we have created here. So, Madam Chair, I am very strongly and supportive of the fives. Well, they're mine, but it gets us back to the mission. So,
thank you. Any other comments? All right. So, do you have questions for us?
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
That's a new one.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 4107A, and we're adjourned.